When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces.
Man, we are at the final chapter.
We're at the end of book one. I can't believe how fast it happened.
I know. It feels like everything has just like shot by so quickly, which has just been, it's just been so much fun the entire time.
Yeah. I've been absolutely loving this so far. I am so excited to jump into Chamber of Secrets next.
I know. Yeah, like a whole new book. We're going to have to go buy like new copies for Mark.
I know. I was just thinking that. I was like, normally we do these like, we'll like record a bunch of episodes like all at once. And I was like, you know what? We don't even have the second book to mark up.
We can't do more work right now.
Can't do more. I will say though that heading into Chamber of Secrets, I do want to make an announcement here as part of the start of the finale episode of book one, is that as of here, January 2024, Happy New Year, we have just launched a brand new project called our Wizarding Candle Club.
Yes, the Wizarding Candle subscription.
Yes, this is gonna
be now available.
Yeah, so we've been working on this for a while, and the way it's going to work is that we have basically a monthly candle subscription. And every month you'll get a brand new mystery, magically scented candle, something inspired by the wizarding world. So month one, since we're heading into Chamber of Secrets right now, we thought there was a pretty obvious first candle that we should do. And it's just called Pretty Obvious. And it smells like lilac. And what's really cool about the candles is that as you burn them, not only are they magically scented, but there's a little bit of magic inside them as well.
There is indeed. Yes, indeed. So as the candle burns down, you will slowly reveal a hidden and collectible charm inside of the candle itself.
Yeah, so each candle has its own unique collectible charm on the inside that you can collect after you burn down the candle. So you have something to look forward to whilst you enjoy the smell. Those are available to sign up. You can sign up to buy individually or sign up for the whole year, just a few months at a time if you want, whatever. But they're available over at wizardingcandles.com.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I was so excited. We secured a domain name.
That made it feel so real.
I know. I was like, wow, this is so neat. This is so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so wizardingcandles.com. They are all hand-poured soy candles. They burn for, it's 2 weeks, and I believe the burn time is about 130 hours.
Yeah, so, they go.
Absolutely. Enjoy. Be sure to go and check those out, wizardingcandles.com. But without any further ado, let's step into Chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces, where arguably, I think the first major occasion of my entire life, at age, what would I have been, like age 8 or 9 years old, probably one of the biggest mind-blown moments.
I know that it wasn't Snape.
That it wasn't Snape.
That it's Quirrell.
That it was Quirrell. Yeah.
I mean, the book sets you up so hard to be Snape. Like,
yes,
almost like openly misdirecting you. I mean, most books that have a twist ending are trying to misdirect you. This one, even when you go back and you know what the twist is, it's like, boy, I don't know. They're really pointing you in the wrong direction here.
It's funny that you say that, actually, because I was thinking, like, you know, as a kid, you know, like when I had read the book, or then like when I got like further away from it, I was like, I bet it was super obvious that it was like Quirrell,
yeah,
the whole time. And then like as you go through, it's like, it's amazing to me how situated he is in each of the instances,
yeah,
but how he is just like the wallpaper of the scene. You know, it's like, you know, nobody's really paying attention to like what's like going on back there. Like, you know, oh, Quirrell fell over when Hermione was trying to light Snape's robe's on fire or whatever. It's like, you like literally, you just don't think twice about it. But then once you know to look, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yes.
And he's there. And then he meets him at the Leaky Cauldron the day that the stone is stolen. And, you know, it's just over and over and over again, like all throughout the story. It's just so much fun. It's so cool to like once you know to like spot it.
I mean, he is there, so there are clues, but like, yeah, the way Snape is positioned too, though, it's like it is a really good reveal when you find out that it's Quirrell, and it's like, what?
Yes.
So, what do you think of the chapter art here for the man with two faces?
I like the chapter art. We have in office, there is an amazing illustration that was done back, like, I think when Think Geek was a company, we would order these posters of each of the various, like, I think they only ended up doing books 1 through 4, possibly either before the artist decided not to continue doing it or the company went out of business, or I don't know what happened.
Yeah, but there's only 4 of them.
Yes, but the imagery that is used depicts the scene that Harry is currently walking into, and I love it because it's basically like, you know, Quirrell standing before like the mirror but facing Harry, but then you can see the reflection of Voldemort
in the mirror
itself. Yeah. And I really like love that imagery. So I could have stood for more Mirror of Erised imagery inside of this rather than what we're getting instead, which is just Quirrell sort of like unwrapping his turban.
Yeah. I do think I was like, part of me is like, oh, it's a little bit spoilery, isn't it? Like, but it's, I mean, at the same rate though, the first sentence is, it was Quirrell. And I mean, it says the man with two faces. The chapter title might be a little spoilery, I suppose, if you think you can predict that by two faces, there's a second face coming out of the back of someone's head.
I know, but it's also like, it's such a double meaning as well, because it's like the idea of being two-faced is sort of like what Quirrell has been this whole time.
That's
like
true. It's just good.
So I think it's pretty clever, but this is like one of those too where it's kind of interesting because, again, when we were kids reading this, or rather our dad was reading it to us, like, it's almost the type of thing where he would have concluded the chapter for the evening. Like, this would have been the end of the reading session for us. So we would have had this sort of, like, moment of, like, oh my gosh, well, Dad, what's going to happen next or whatever? But then, like, we wouldn't turn the page.
Right.
You know, like,
you would just be left on, there was already someone there, but it wasn't Snape. It wasn't even Voldemort.
Yes, yeah. So at that point in time, Dad would fold the corner of the page or whatever and shut the book. And so you wouldn't see. But then now, as like a, you know, more matured reader or whatever, even if I was going to end my reading session at the end of the night or at the end of the chapter, you know, you would still turn the page and see like the first line,
right?
You know, at which point in time, chances are you're not going to sleep anymore,
right?
Like, you know, you're like, no,
Quirrell.
No, it was cool. What?
Huh?
Okay, I'm going to have to know.
Including the line in the last, or including the phrase, "It wasn't even Voldemort," really throws you off because then you might think, oh, well, then Voldemort's not there,
right? That's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So that's, which isn't totally correct. It's just not. He just hasn't realized that Voldemort is there.
Yeah. So there's that.
The other interesting thing I just have to say real quick before we dive into all the nitty gritty details is the just astonishing fact that this is the last chapter of the book. Just simply because this is literally like him walking into the climax of the story. So like, what I mean, sure, it's like the last major thing that happens, but it never ceases to amaze me that he enters the chamber and discovers it's Quirrell on page 1, and then the last thing, the last exchange, has to do with the Dursleys back in London.
Right, like, so it's inside, like, the same chapter, he fights Voldemort and reunites with the Dursleys.
And it's like, wait, no, surely
that's the same chapter.
Yeah, surely it's two different. Yeah,
like the number of things that happen in this chapter, like Harry discovers it was Quirrell, comes face to back with Voldemort, gets the stone out of the mirror, kills Quirrell, wakes up in the hospital wing, has the whole end of book breakdown with Dumbledore, has the end of book breakdown with Ron and Hermione, goes to the feast, wins the house cup, and then takes a train ride home. Like, all of that is in this chapter.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's remarkable. It's jam-packed. I mean, it's probably a case study in using words intentionally. Yeah,
this is some very concise writing.
Yes, exactly. Like, in order to fit all that in there without it feeling extraordinarily rushed, which, again, you know, like, I never even realized this was the case. So, kind of impressive on that front. But anyway, so basically we get Harry's just you know, utter amazement that the person that he's actually facing is Quirrell. And even like, you know, of course, you know, I'm listening and reading to each chapter to kind of get like both vibes a little bit. Mm-hmm. But like the voice used for Quirrell, just sort of like without the stutter, just like the "me," he said calmly, "I wondered whether I'd be meeting you here, Potter." It's like all of a sudden Quirrell does seem like a lot more formidable,
right away.
Right, you know, you're like, it's like the fact,
like, because you're simultaneously realizing that he's been the villain the whole time and that he has been like faking the stutter. Like, it has all been such an act that like everything you thought about him was a lie, which means the opposite must be true. That like, oh, if he's not cowering and like nervous, then he must actually be really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, and this is sort of like a thing that, I mean, I don't know how to translate exactly to people, you know, out there in the real world, but I mean, it's like so weird if you thought like something that was a cornerstone of somebody who you know personally, like if you're like, this is like the main thing I know about you, and then to have that like dissolved, it's sort of like, wait a second, I don't know you at all.
Exactly.
Like everything that I thought I knew, now I have to like revisit every conversation. Now I have to reimagine every like instance, every impulse. Like,
right.
You know, like what does this change about everything I thought I knew? So I did write a note here, though, that I wish I could relive this moment again for the first time, just because I do remember the absolute state of shock. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting is just the sentiment I just said out loud, which is the, I wonder whether or not I'd be meeting you here, Potter. This is something in my head that, again, like whenever I like recall the story without thinking of the specific details, in my head, it almost seems like Voldemort like intends to encounter Harry at the end.
Yeah.
But I it's like, that's not explicitly true. Like, I mean, on some level, it's a little bit of like a coincidence that they both happen to be in there. And otherwise, Quirrell is just in the chamber that night, and he's just quit, like, you know, he's just going to fail at getting the stone. He's just going to try again a different day.
Right.
Like,
that's the thing. Or if he can even get out, you know, like that's the other part of it. Like if like that, so it, there's a weird thing at the end of the chapter where it seems like Harry believes that Dumbledore like intended for him to try and go down and stop Quirrell/Voldemort.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Which is an interesting thought, because at the same rate, it's like if Quirrell tries to go down there and steal the stone like by himself, like he's not going to be able to get it. Like there's no need for Harry, like he'll just fail because he can't get it out of the mirror, and he's like never going to be able to get it out of the mirror. So it's like, and then the fact that Harry is like uniquely capable of getting the stone out of the mirror, like if Dumbledore intended for Harry to go down there but hid the stone in a mirror that he knows Harry alone is going to be able to get the stone out of, it's like you had a perfect system, but you like sort of introduced this glaring weakness to the problem.
And here's the thing, because this is like the big question. So Ethan, our editor, was chatting with us after I think last week's episode, and he was like, you guys might need to explain Dumbledore's big plan a little bit more like at length, basically, because it's one of these things that we've made a huge video series about over on the Super Carlin Brothers YouTube channel. We've spent a lot of time talking about it. We probably do speak a little bit here on the show as if people sort of like understand that concept or what we're presenting, as if this is like a known,
right,
you know, like a known way to perceive the story. So with that being said, I think we can take your exact point here and maybe like give like a crash course on the overall big plan.
Sure.
Because on some level, I feel like what you could make the argument for, because I had the same thought as I was reading through this chapter. I'm like, realistically, Harry being in the chamber beneath the school with Quirrell and the mirror is worse for protecting the stone than anything else.
Right.
And we've always sort of made the argument that we believe that like the reason why like what's happening is like Dumbledore is knowing each of the Golden Trio's specific strengths. So the reason that there's a chess set is on purpose because Ron can beat the chess set. The reason there's a logic puzzle is because Hermione can beat the logic puzzle. Because the reason there's a flying puzzle is because Harry is, can beat it. Is the seeker. Yeah, exactly. Even Fluffy is sort of an obstacle that is brought to the table by none other than Hagrid, who has been like one of Harry's other best friends inside of the wizarding world.
Right.
And on some level, you know, like Dumbledore sort of has this like immense trust for Hagrid, and we've kind of suggested or alluded to the idea that maybe part of that trust is knowing exactly how Hagrid will behave for better or for worse.
Right.
Like Dumbledore is only ever willing to trust Hagrid with information that he is okay with slipping in the ways that he knows Hagrid could slip. So
right.
you're definitely providing a lot of puppeteering perspective for Dumbledore and basically suggesting that this whole first year, you know, especially even as you fast forward to the Prince's Tale in Deathly Hallows, like there's the one throwaway line that I know we've brought up a million times, but it's Dumbledore basically advising Snape or requesting of Snape, like, keep an eye on Quirrell, won't you? So it's like even that somewhat suggests that like Dumbledore knows that there's a reason to be watching out for one of his own teachers inside of his own school throughout the whole year. I mean, he could just sack Quirrell at any time.
Dumbledore could if he's so concerned about Quirrell, like, yeah, he could just fire him at any point that he wants.
Right. So so my rough argument here on some level would be that I think that Dumbledore feels very in control this whole first year of all of the players. I think he kind of knows just about where everybody is on the map.
Yeah.
And I think that like a lot of what he's doing is like watching events unfold and attempting to learn more about not just Harry and Voldemort, but what their relationship might be like with one another. And in the grand scheme of things, like what does it mean for Harry to be the one capable of defeating the Dark Lord? Because going into school, going into this year of school, even the Death Eaters, like part of the reason Malfoy extends a hand of friendship to Harry is because the Death Eaters believe that Harry could be the second coming of the Dark Lord.
Right. Like that's how he was able to defeat Voldemort, because he's an even darker, more powerful wizard.
Exactly. Yeah. So for Harry to be the one capable of defeating Voldemort isn't explicitly saying it's for the good.
Right.
That might just be suggesting that like this guy can beat him, but he's your bigger problem.
Right. Yeah.
So to me, my interpretation, my suggestion that I would lob out into the ether would basically be that what we're getting here is Dumbledore is attempting to understand who Harry is at his core. What does this person stand for?
That's probably why he lets him find the mirror.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. I mean, and I think that that's a big, big, big step. You know, he gives him the invisibility cloak. He gives it to him over Christmas. He has the mirror planted out in the middle of the school, available in a classroom just to be entered.
Yeah.
You know,
where is the stone at that point?
Right. I mean, precisely. Like, you know, at this point in time, Dumbledore is just like, no, it's not really a risk. Like, that's not the problem.
Right, yeah. It's like, that's like the grand facade of this whole book is that Dumbledore cares at all if Voldemort gets the stone. Like, the whole thing is a big, like, no, that's really not important here. It's I don't care. Even if he gets it, I don't care. That's not a big deal. That's not what I'm testing here.
It's like a bit of a farce. Like, it's almost like maybe even, like, and again, like I said, like, you know, he knows, like, all the players on the map and everything. It's like, maybe even Dumbledore knows, it's like, you're not actually going to be able to do what you think you're going to be able to do with the Elixir of Life. Like even if you get it, even if you get hands on it, I don't think that you're going to be able to return the way that you think you're going to be able to return. And I think this was sort of something we were chatting about with the team a little bit, but even the fact that Nicholas Flamel's like age at this moment is 665.
Yeah.
And like by the destruction of the stone itself, meaning he won't become 666 years old.
Yeah. That feels like intentional.
It feels a little intentional. It feels to me like a little bit like even like possibly Nicholas Flamel was like Dumbledore's not guarding the stone or something. It's like, this is all like strategic. Maybe, and you know, we even talked about the centaurs. Maybe it's written in the stars.
Right.
You know,
like, because we just made a video over on the main Super Carlin Brothers channel about how like the centaurs read the sky and stuff, and how Dumbledore has that pocket watch with the 12 planets, with like all the little 12 hands planets, and all the planets on. And it's like, there's no reason to overcomplicate telling the time.
Right.
Like, what is the point of that watch? And it's like, what if the point of that watch is just like, that's his way to like glance at the future rather than at this, you know, at the sky or something.
Right.
So it's like, maybe he's able to like, you know, discern more information because he can read the planets in the same way that the centaurs can, even though most wizards can't.
Right. Exactly. And so basically the proposal would be that a lot of what you're seeing inside of this, and a lot of the reason, because I mean, we've said it a million times, but like, why would there be obstacles guarding the stone? That's an obstacle just merely suggests that like, if you're willing to beat, or if you're able to beat our challenges, then yeah, go right ahead.
Go ahead and take
it's like,
it.
It's like, it's almost as if like, yeah, if you can beat us, then you're entitled to the prize at the end of the journey. Yeah. And it's like, wrong, you know? Yeah. Like, that's not how anybody protects anything.
Right. And it's like, and the obstacles just don't matter because no one can get through the mirror anyway.
Exactly.
Like, you may as well put it up in the Great Hall and say, the stone's in here. Like, there's nothing anyone can do about it unless you're Harry.
Right. Yeah. So what it really does, and exactly what you know you brought up already, and what Harry says is that let's see here, I want to get the exact line from Harry, but it's basically when he's telling Ron and Hermione that he thinks that Dumbledore pretty much was giving them the opportunity to take a stab at it if they so desired. But I also, yeah, so he's a funny man, Dumbledore. I think he sort of wanted to give me a chance. I think he knows more or less everything that goes on here, you know? I reckon he had a pretty good idea we were going to try, and instead of stopping us, he just taught us enough to help. I don't think it was an accident. He let me find out how the mirror worked. It's almost like he thought I had the right to face Voldemort if I could. But the thing is that I just don't see a world where Dumbledore is actually... Did you highlight it?
I highlighted that whole paragraph.
The thing is that I just don't think that Dumbledore would actively send a lamb in for slaughter.
No. Well, like, that's the thing, is that either he doesn't really think that, like, Voldemort getting the stone is that big a deal, or having seen what Harry saw in the mirror, he's confident that it doesn't matter if Harry gets the stone out while Quirrell is there with Voldemort. Like, they can't beat Harry. Like, he already has enough faith in him.
Yes.
Like, it's of no concern. Like, Harry will already beat you.
Right. And so I think, and then what we ultimately know as well is that, like, when Dumbledore is talking about Harry's greatness, you know, when they're in limbo in King's Cross Station after Harry has faced death, you know, in the Forbidden Forest at the hands of Voldemort, one of the first things that Dumbledore brings up is like, do you know how few people could have seen what you saw in that mirror? Like,
yeah.
Like, he is talking about Harry's just innate uniqueness. His unique nobility, which even the moment that Harry wakes up in the hospital wing, I feel like there's a couple of really interesting tidbits there. One of which is that when Harry first wakes up, he sees something gold glinting just above him, the snitch. He tried to catch it, but his arms were too heavy. He blinked. It wasn't a snitch at all. It was a pair of glasses. How strange. I think it's so interesting to me that, like, Harry's effectively coming up from darkness and is mistaking what he's seeing, which is the kind eyes of Albus Dumbledore, mm-hmm. as a snitch, when also eventually Dumbledore will give him a golden snitch
yeah.
Specifically so that he's able to go in reverse order and accept death.
Right.
Like, it's like the scene just plays itself out in the other direction.
You're right. I did not interpret it that way, but I do really like that that reading of it.
Yes.
That's,
but then
very clever.
Even Harry's immediate reaction upon waking up is that his immediate concern is for the stone itself.
Right.
And over again, you know, Dumbledore is attempting to explain to him, like, you know, what's happened, and instead of ever being concerned about, like, his own health, what happened to me? What happened? You know, it's like, he's like, Voldemort has the stone.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Like, I need to warn you.
It's
like,
bad. Come on. Hold on. Listen.
Yes. And so, you know, they're going back and forth, and Dumbledore says, 3 days, Mr. Ronald Weasley and Mrs. Granger will be most relieved to have come around. They have been extremely worried. But, sir, the stone. I see you are not to be distracted. Very well, the stone. Professor Quirrell did not manage to take it from you. I arrived in time to prevent that. So I mean, it's just like, even in, like, and I mean, this is Harry through and through, you know, like, this is like the innate goodness, the innate bravery that this, you know, soul is capable of possessing, is that, I mean, he's just like, he doesn't have false intentions. He's not seeking glory. He is just literally trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And I think personally, that's the point of all of book one, is Dumbledore wants to learn whether or not that's what he has with on his side.
Yeah. So I don't know if we actually, to round that off, if we're going to try and explain the premise of Dumbledore's big plan, then, as it fits into the greater thing, is that the idea behind Dumbledore's big plan is that Dumbledore is the only one who knows the full prophecy, having been the one it was made to.
Right.
Meaning he alone knows that Harry is, like, destined to possibly defeat Voldemort.
Right.
And since he knows that by himself, he is able to, like, quietly pull the strings on Harry's life and guide him towards that ultimate end. And if you're like looking for it, you can see the ways in which he is directing Harry's life because he knows the prophecy.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's basically sending him through, you know, like a maze of sorts, attempting to, you know, kind of like whittle him into exactly who he needs to be in order to successfully face death.
Right. Yes. You know?
It all culminates there.
And there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of clouds on the map too. Like at this point, like Dumbledore doesn't know about the Horcruxes or anything.
That's also true. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff that Dumbledore himself hasn't been able to fully piece together, but things that Harry will actively contribute to rather significantly and absolutely starting with our next book, Chamber of Secrets. So we'll get into that as we get there. But in the meantime, I think we've made it about four sentences into this chapter so far.
We've made it far.
We've covered a lot, though, so I don't think we don't have to necessarily go hyper-aggressively. But where would you like to go from here?
Well, I think it's interesting that, I mean, not to get stuck on the fourth sentence again, but he says, I wondered whether I'd be meeting you here, Potter. And it's like interesting to me that Quirrell was concerned he'd meet the first year Harry Potter and not like Snape or one of the professors or something. Like Quirrell's concerned about Harry.
Right.
Like he knew like, he hasn't actually been that meddlesome, but he does say like, no, I tried to kill you. I'm like, even that, I'm like, why were you trying to kill Harry? Like what had he done to that point that was like, I gotta get rid of that 11-year-old. He is gonna mess up my plans.
Right. Well, like, so do you not think at this point in time that Voldemort has just been being like, hey, that's the one, that's the kid we don't like.
I guess that's probably it, I guess. He talks about how Hermione broke his eye contact. I'm like, that's just never how jinxes are described again for the rest of the book, the rest of the series. So I think that's interesting.
There's another one of those where just a couple paragraphs later we get Quirrell snapped his fingers, ropes sprang out of thin air and wrapped themselves tightly around Harry. That's some pretty impressive.
Yeah, some pretty impressive nonverbal.
Wandless and nonverbal magic.
Like, yeah, like, whoops, that's crazy. I mean, yeah. I guess, again, Voldemort, maybe he's teaching him some tricks and stuff.
Could be. I guess so. Yep, absolutely.
I love where he says, like, why do you think Snape wanted to referee your next match? But then he's wanted to make sure that I didn't try and kill you again, but he needn't have bothered. I couldn't do anything with Dumbledore watching. All the other teachers thought Snape was trying to stop Gryffindor from winning. He did make himself unpopular, which I love that because it's like Dumbledore lets that happen. It's like right. Nobody be like, Snape, don't worry. Like great instincts on trying to protect Harry. I'll be there, so you don't got to worry about it.
Everything's gonna be just fine. But I will be delighted to watch you fly around and try to do this.
Go ahead and get up there. Make yourself unpopular.
Right. Like I think there's like a foul that he presents to the other team, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So maybe Snape is just out of his depth. He's like, it's not that he's even picking on Gryffindor. He's just like,
he just doesn't know how Quidditch works.
What are the rules again?
That'd be so funny. Oh man, that's I like that. That's good. If he just doesn't know how to do it at all.
Yep. Especially when you just consider the fact that I mean, like Quidditch seems to be the thing that, or one of the things that Snape despises so much about James's whole like character as a Hogwarts student, which almost certainly suggests that Snape was not on the Slytherin squad.
There's no way Snape played Quidditch at all. Yeah,
without it coming up. Yeah. But it seems like eventually Battle of the Seven Potters, he must be a pretty okay flyer.
So yeah. I mean, I can see it being something that motivates him highly to be like, well, if that's the kind of thing that Lily likes, I got to be good at brooms.
Yeah, there you go. Otherwise, I did have a little note here as this exchange is going on. It's just it reminds me so much of The Incredibles, where he's like, he starts monologuing.
Oh my gosh, I know. I even wrote down, it's just like, he's needlessly open.
I know, yeah. He's just like, I got to tell you everything about how this year unfolded and why all of it is did exactly what it did. So I did write a note down as well as whether or not some of the monologue is like for the benefit of the reader.
Oh, I mean, 1,000% it is.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of like what's happening here is it's basically like this thing that happened. Let me try to explain to you why like that happened so that you don't end up always just asking the question What am I trying to say here? So you're not always just asking the question like, well, why didn't this just happen? Why didn't this just happen? It's like, well, I got to explain.
Oh, I mean, yes, this is just like an exposition trick that happens. It's like, oh yeah, here's all the twists revealed. There you go. So yeah, I think that's really what happens. It does. There's a funny thing where it's like he had to keep Quirrell from giving his whole attention to the mirror. I love like Harry's determination to like stop him from doing it. And it's like, you really don't. Like there's nothing he can do. He can't get it out. Not that Harry knows that the mirror works right there. But yeah, he did like Quirrell's just like, yeah, Voldemort, he's with me wherever I go. It's like, you don't need to tell him that. You don't have to tell him that.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to talk to him at all.
Come I literally on, wrote man. Down surprisingly candid.
Yeah, surprisingly candid. Okay, I think this is funny. He says he does not, or when he's talking about Voldemort, he said does not forgive mistakes easily. When I failed to steal the stone from Gringotts, he was most displeased, which I find pretty funny because you'd have thought that on some level Voldemort must have been a little bit validated by Gringotts' defenses in keeping Quirrell out, because at this moment Voldemort is already hiding one of his Horcruxes at Gringotts.
You know? That's true. Yeah, right? Yeah. The Hufflepuff's cup.
Right. Like, yeah. Had Quirrell successfully stolen the stone, he'd have to have been like Bellatrix. Like, we got to move, because it turns out pretty easy to steal stuff. Even Quirrell got it.
Quirrell figured it out.
I wasn't even with him then. He just did it.
I know. Which that is one of those things that they actually do include the line specifically that was. How could he have been so stupid? He'd seen Quirrell there that very day, shaking hands with him at the Leaky Cauldron. This is like, I think, one of those things where a lot of people have posed the question before in the past, like, why doesn't Quirrell melt when they shake hands at the Leaky Cauldron?
Right.
So this is definitely clarifying that exact thing. So I think we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Voldemort is not occupying Quirrell's body when they meet at the Leaky Cauldron.
No, and so, then because he fails to steal the stone, that is the catalyst for him occupying his body. Like,
yes.
You stink, man. I gotta keep closer eyes on you. Can't be relying on your instincts. Can't even rob a bank. Jeez.
Exactly. The next thing, though, is whether or not it almost certainly seems like Voldemort is using Legilimens on Harry,
yeah,
you know, in order to sort of figure out how to get the rest of this to unfold. So he almost seems to be realizing that there's a chance that Harry knows more about the mirror than Quirrell does. And like, so he then starts whispering, use the boy.
Those are his first words, right?
Are they?
Are those his first words in the book, in the story, or use the boy?
Wow. Yeah,
that's pretty interesting, right?
That is pretty interesting. Yeah. I always remember, this is really funny and just a total aside anecdote, but I remember in a very, very, very early Jay versus Ben, which is our Harry Potter trivia show.
Yeah.
There was a day where it was like, what are the first words that Voldemort mutters after his resurrection in the graveyard of Little Hangleton? And the first thing he says upon physical form is, robe me.
Yeah. Give me some clothes.
And I'm always like, is he just standing there in his nudie pants?
Pretty much.
How embarrassing.
I know. Jeez.
Let's see.
But yeah, use the boy. So they get Harry in front of the mirror. Harry just immediately and successfully lies to Quirrell, who doesn't second guess him at all.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. I thought, I think Quirrell does not press hard enough at all right there. And then we already sort of talked about it. So it feels like sort of bad design by Dumbledore if he intends for Harry to interfere, but Harry is also the only one who can get the stone out. Like, boy, if Harry just hadn't gone down there, then what happens? Then they're just stuck.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the other big curiosity as well, is a couple of things. One is that, like, if Harry doesn't go down here, then is there a way for Quirrell to escape? The other question is that we know that the battle is about to go down, and that in doing so, Dumbledore is able to successfully get through to the dungeon.
Yeah.
And so part of my question is, like, there's a secret trap door that's being guarded by Fluffy. Is there an even secreter trap door,
right,
that Dumbledore like pops in through the roof and just like falls through the rafters and it's like, what up?
Yeah, like, did Dumbledore have to like play through the chess set and stuff?
I know, yeah, that's the question. Because right. I mean, you have to imagine at that point in time that like he must have been literally on their heels, or even just like watching them pass through it themselves, waiting for his turn.
Oh, I know. Yeah, right. So, like, I mean, if he gets there with enough time, with just enough time to pull Harry off, it seems like whilst they're in the potion room, he's like right behind them playing chess.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like, he has to be that close, or like, it wouldn't. I mean, getting past Fluffy and the Devil's Snare would both take almost zero time at all if you know they're there. And Dumbledore knows they're all there. I can even see Dumbledore just being able to like summon the appropriate key out of the air. Sure. Like without, like, I just think he's probably magical enough to do it. Although, right. That he doesn't have to like fly around forever catching it.
I know, which would seem so silly. Like, yeah. You know, but I mean, it is one of those things where it would be kind of interesting, you know, like in a long form, like film or TV show format to almost like be cutting in between Dumbledore having to like endure all of these,
right.
All of these tasks. And so you're sort of like, is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? Because that would be really fun for anybody who had never seen or read this story before. Yeah. It'd be like kind of like an interesting way. It's like, well, Harry's about to face his doom right now.
Like, come on,
he has
Dumbledore.
No way out. And you haven't even caught the key yet? Oh yeah. My gosh.
Jeez.
I know.
Then the chess set, I could just see it being like, hurry up. Like,
I know, yeah.
Because like presumably he's not just going to like four move checkmate. No, but they're playing black anyway, so it's like you have your work cut out for you playing against this chess set. You know, it's not going to be a short game.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, then the potion, obviously the troll's already down to the potion. He knows exactly what the right answer is, so just pick it up and go.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, the fire in the potion room should stop Quirrell from getting out.
It should.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you wouldn't have any other way to get out.
Right.
Yeah.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Griffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish, but that is really just the start, because from there you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped, because like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good, and they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening it's already passed, but like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can, and it's so easy to change between them. Like, they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this, because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
We start to get like the real battle unfolding between Voldemort, who is now just facing Harry full on. And I thought there was like one piece of dialogue in particular that kind of stood out to me that I hadn't caught before. But Voldemort to Harry says, "Don't be a fool. Better save your own life and join me, or you'll meet the same end as your parents. They died begging me for mercy." "Liar!" Harry shouted suddenly. And then Voldemort responds with, "How touching. I always value bravery." And this is kind of an interesting one. And goes back to like one of our other kind of big theories, which is what, because that's obviously like a very Gryffindor trait.
Yeah.
You know, valuing bravery. And I mean, he could just be being sarcastic, manipulative or evil, yeah, or whatever. But it is kind of fascinating, because we know as much as Voldemort is a Slytherin and buys into these sort of like very fanatical, radical, pure-blooded beliefs that supposedly come from Salazar Slytherin,
yeah,
himself. We know that he was still willing to use Hufflepuff's cup, Ravenclaw's diadem, you know, and then, yeah, and then was looking for something from Gryffindor,
right,
in order to make his final Horcrux. So this is kind of one of those things where it's like it's kind of hard to like wrap your head around, or it was for me at least, is that in my head, I would imagine that Tom Riddle hates Gryffindor. Like, he would hate everything to do with Gryffindor. But he doesn't really. Like, he has a fascination with the founders of Hogwarts.
Well, because he loves Hogwarts.
Because he loves Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, and so, like when it comes down to it, this basically what I'm suggesting is I feel like that line in particular, I was like, I feel like it's another feather in the cap for the idea that he did, in fact, when he was going to kill Harry in Godric's Hollow, he had the Sword of Gryffindor with him.
One of my favorite theories, absolutely, is that he had the sword with him when he went to go kill Harry and was intending for that to be his last Horcrux.
Yes.
I also thought what's interesting about that passage is that when he says, better save your own life and join me, like, this is like, it's not really something that, like, that offer for Harry to join Voldemort never really comes up again.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, it feels like maybe that could have been like a plot line, like, very, you know, Luke and the Emperor kind of thing, where it's like, oh, yeah, don't worry about beating him. We'll just get him to our side.
Right.
But it's like, and there's even, I think, a moment earlier in this book where Harry is like, I'm never going to the dark side or something. So I'm almost surprised there's not like a section of the book where you're like wondering if Harry's like going down the wrong path. He's getting a little darker.
I know.
But like, yeah, it's like he says he's never going to do it. He refuses him here. And Voldemort's like, all right, good enough for me. This kid's solid.
Yeah, he's like, hey, ironclad.
Ironclad.
He is surely in extreme opposition to me.
Yeah.
But it is also kind of interesting that he would even extend that offer of joining him, because at this point in time, at least Voldemort himself knows enough of the prophecy to know that neither can live while the other survives.
Right.
So it's like you would never benefit from having even Harry on your side, even if he was willing to do it.
Oh, like, well, I mean, even the offer, I feel like, is a lie.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, he just wants Harry to join him to get the stone, and then I think he'd kill him no matter what. He doesn't genuinely want an ally.
Right.
But, it's like he never goes for this tact ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was a weird question, and this is like half-baked at best, but it was, when I was wondering about, like, if he got the stone and he was going to use it, like, I sort of imagine, like Quirrell either, like, touching the stone to, like, this vaporeal, you know, mist that he's existing at. I was like, would that then, like, transmute the mist into, like, a physical body? And if so, would it be gold?
Oh, I think it turns metal into gold.
I mean, it does turn metal into gold. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the mist surely isn't metal, so probably not that. But I was like, it would be so interesting if somehow we had like a really tanned,
yeah, right.
You know, like just, you know, bronze or something.
Right.
Because he's always described it so like pale or almost like semi-translucent.
Yeah.
You know,
if he was just like shining,
yeah.
If like all the iron in his blood was now gold, yeah.
Right. That would be super interesting. But yeah, it's always been kind of one of those things where I was like, what would he do?
I know it says it produces the elixir of life, and I'm like, what does that mean? Like, is there like liquid pouring out of the stone? Do you like touch it to water and it turns it into the elixir of life? Would you just touch Voldemort with the stone and he would get his body back?
Right. Like, it almost feels more like an ingredient, but I could almost see a world where it is such a complex ingredient that what you're adding it to is something as simple as like water, you know,
right.
Like it's just like water and Philosopher's Stone gives you the elixir of life.
Right.
And that is how you can sustain life. But the other thing we know, at least from the Fantastic Beasts movies, is that at this point in time, Nicholas Flamel is not in good health. Like, or at the very least, he's quite frail.
Yeah.
You know, from this extraordinarily long existence. So it's that's the other thing that I've always found kind of fascinating, is that like it doesn't really feel like the stone would give him strength and power and body and form in the same way that what we ultimately see unfold in Little Hangleton, mm-hmm. where he does, you know, like achieve his body. Like what he ultimately ends up doing almost seems better than what he's attempting to do right here.
Well, I think this is just to get his body back. I think Dumbledore ultimately says that is like the stone would have been able to give him his body back, but after that he would have continued to rely on his Horcruxes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I got you.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So I think this is just get back to a corporeal form.
Kind of a husk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. But then from there, we sort of get like, you know, the very classic. And this was like one of those things, again, as a kid, as I was listening to it, I was like, I don't know how Harry wins. You know, like, I mean, I was like,
because Quirrell refuses to use his wand.
I know.
Like, I literally wrote that. He says, Master, I cannot hold him. Like, I literally wrote, dude, use your wand.
Which hilariously is the exact opposite problem Voldemort himself has when he's going to attack baby Harry.
It's right.
Like he probably could have been successful using any other method other than Avada Kedavra / magic.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like, I mean, I don't know. So it's kind
I don't
of
know. Do you think he would have been?
In my mind, I feel like what Harry is most protected by is by magic. And this is another one of those, like, Voldemort could not be Voldemort if he was capable of loving. Like, if Voldemort was capable of using a non-magical method of attacking Harry, then it could work.
I think because he kills Lily with the Avada Kedavra, it's like Lily's spell is protecting Harry, like, specifically from Voldemort, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
What do you think I'm saying?
So I think if he had, like, stabbed Lily, if he'd managed to kill her without magic.
Something. Stabbed. Nice.
Yeah. Or, yeah. Whatever the case. I think if he Avada Kedavra is, if everything else is the same, but then he pulls out a knife and tries to, like, stab Harry, then, like, that knife still doesn't work.
Okay. Yeah. So you think he is protected from Voldemort basically no matter what?
Yeah.
Like it would just, like, ping off him.
I think so.
Okay.
I don't know.
That's an interesting one. I feel like that's like some room for conversation.
Does seem like that could be. On like the other hand, like if there had been like someone else in the room and they had just done the spell, like, yeah, then Harry's doomed.
Right.
This is constantly his problem. Like, just let someone else do it, man.
I know. But yeah. So that's the other question as well, though, is that if the prophecy is at work and if you subscribe to the prophecy at all, then was Harry safe of all other physical maladies forever and for always? So like when he falls off his broomstick in Prisoner, you know, and falls like hundreds of feet, you know, Dumbledore catches him at the last second, but Dumbledore was always going to catch him. Somebody was always going to catch him at the last second because he was never going to die that way.
I don't think so. I think he could have died from other means. Not like the prophecy is like, you know, glowing bright blue every time Harry nears death and is like, whoa, make something happen.
It's like, we need to interject.
Whoa.
Yeah. That's okay. That's a big question. And how much is like the path laid out before you kind of thing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's just that Voldemort puts so much stock by the prophecy that, like, he believes in it so much that no matter what, he is going to continue to hunt Harry, which guarantees that one of them will kill the other.
Okay.
Because even if Harry's like, I don't believe in the prophecy, like, it doesn't matter because Voldemort does. So he will always try and kill Harry. So,
right,
so Harry will always have to defend himself.
Yes, or, yeah. Or just let him win.
Yeah. Or just let him win, which is what he does.
To Voldemort's dismay.
To Voldemort's dismay.
There we go. But so then this is the other big question, is that there's always a little bit of like a dark thing, especially the film, because Harry does ultimately end up defending himself using his hands, which ultimately melts Quirrell into like a form of ash or something. It's absolutely in self-defense no matter what. But this is one of those where it almost seems like the way that it's phrased possibly could be sparing Harry from having been the one who does actually kill him. Like, I think Dumbledore says, like, I arrived just in time, to pull Quirrell off of you.
Yeah.
Which we know that Quirrell ends up not surviving the exchange because he's not anywhere else. But it also might mean that Harry was not the one to, like, snuff him out.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so
it's like, I don't think Harry gets credit for having killed Quirrell.
Right. Yeah. So I don't really know what ultimately does take him, or if he's just so weakened by the exchange that he just.
Yeah. What does it say? I feel like maybe it's something to do with like Voldemort exiting his body is what maybe kills him. Like he can't touch Harry without enduring the pain, but then like when I think that's why Quirrell has to drink the unicorn blood, because like Voldemort's basically like a big parasite on him.
And right, he's actively weakening
him. Sort of weakening him. And then like when he's like, all right, see ya, like then that's it.
Right, yeah. Right. And I think that even when you delve into like when he's talking about his return again in Goblet of Fire, I think he says that he was able to like occupy like snakes and rats. But like his presence was too much for most of them as well. So I suppose it stands to reason that like a human in the form of Quirrell could handle it for longer than a snake or a rat could.
Yeah.
But eventually it was still going to
get there
too much. So I think you could easily make the argument that Voldemort is the one as a parasite that kills.
Yeah. Cause there's just something where like Dumbledore shows just as little concern for his like allies as he does his enemies. Where is that line in this chapter? I feel like I just read it. He left Quirrell to die.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
He shows just as little mercy to his followers as his enemies.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. So.
So there's that.
I think Voldemort leaving Quirrell is what kills Quirrell.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So we can spare Harry of collecting his first kill at age 11.
Well, because the thing is, like, we know Harry doesn't have a split soul, so I don't think.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, yes. That's sort of like one of those, like, is it. in doing it in self-defense, does that matter? Like, would that still split your soul if you killed someone in self-defense?
I mean, yeah, that's some whole other...
That feels like another layers of magic.
Yeah. So that's a completely different moral debate. But, I mean, it seems to me as though it would be different.
Yeah.
It feels that way.
Yeah.
Versus like this premeditated type
of... Oh, I just thought of something. Okay. Is that like, interestingly, Harry passes out, so he doesn't actually witness Quirrell die either, which means the Thestrals remain invisible to him as well.
So, I mean, this is always the question as well when it comes to that is... does he witness his mother's death?
Oh, right. Yeah, that's another weird one, right?
Because
it's like clear. It's like he seems like he was awake and he has memories of it.
Yes.
And he continues to remember more and more of it.
Right. So that's more of like a question of is he actively remembering, or like was the magical reverberations kind of similar to that of like a vinyl record being able to, you know, store music through like vibrations.
Right.
It's almost like, is he more like imprinted on of the event based on all of the intensity that existed in the room.
Right.
So it's like he can hear these like echoes of what happened, even if he doesn't have like an actual memory of it.
Right. Cause he like remembers the green light and he can hear the screaming and he can even hear like the dialogue at some point after the Dementors get closer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Lily pleading for his life.
It clearly never ends up counting for the Thestrals.
It's not until Cedric.
Not until Cedric. And even then it apparently takes time to process because Cedric dies and then they like leave for the summer and he can't see the Thestrals when they go down to the train at the end of four, which honestly feels like more of a mistake if you ask me.
It does feel a little bit like that. Like,
this is supposed to be a book five thing. So
yeah, but it's not quite there. I can't.
He hasn't processed Cedric's death yet.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. I do think we have an entire video about that somewhere where I feel like we found some nugget or some morsel that was like, see, now is when it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this is the moment where he's like fully open.
I think I want to say there's even like maybe like Harry's eyes are like described as being closed when Cedric dies. So like maybe he didn't see him die or something, which would be even worse. But
But then,
how can he see him?
Right.
Yeah.
We're getting way too far ahead. Talking about Thestrals at the end of book one. Okay, so what else do we have here in this chapter to close out? Because we've made it out of the chamber. We get back to conversation with Dumbledore, who is now kind of like willing to provide
the lightest bit of context.
just like a little bit. So it's kind of interesting because he like Dumbledore is in a very strange position because Harry has now quite literally put his life on the line. Like Harry's got, you know, like skin in the game, so to speak. And from Dumbledore's perspective, he's faced with his own ethical quandary a little bit, which is like, to what extent do you provide or allow Harry to have some semblance of a childhood?
Yeah.
Some semblance of what life was supposed to be like. The thing that largely has been robbed from him for most of his life under, you know, like the roof of the Dursleys, through his family being like ripped apart just as a baby. So it's like, you know, Dumbledore is, he says here that like, I can't tell you everything, but I also promise not to lie to you. He says, let's see here. The truth, Dumbledore sighed. It was a beautiful and terrible thing and should therefore be treated with great caution, which I think is a really, really spectacular sentence. However, I shall answer your questions unless I have a very good reason not to, in which case I beg you'll forgive me. I shall not, of course, lie. And as you start to like read some of these exchanges, so then, of course, Harry basically asks right away, like, you know... like why did Voldemort, like this is like the biggest question that we all are asking in the whole series. Why did Voldemort want to kill him as a baby?
Right.
You know, so at this point in time, nobody's mentioned
the prophecy. You
know, breath of word of the prophecy. Yeah.
Well, that's the answer to that one.
Yes. Yeah. So he can't says that. And of course he says, alas, the first thing you've asked me, I cannot tell you. Not today. You will know one day. And this is, you know, that's a little bit of the sparing of, you know, like the burden that Harry has placed upon him. And I do think that this would be something that would be very, very, very difficult, you know, as somebody who knows more about a child's situation than the child themselves or whether or not to tell them. I think it would even be difficult for me if my own daughter Addison asked me questions that were, before her time and I would be struggling like, I will eventually explain this to you, but today is not the day. Right. Like I think it would be hard for me to say that. Like,
I know.
If she thought to ask the question, there's going to be a compulsion in me to tell her the answer.
I don't know. Like, I'll just tell you the truth.
You know, if you were curious enough, then
yeah. If you were smart enough to think of the question, then you must be ready for the answer.
Right. So then we move forward, though, and we learn a little bit, about the relationship between, Professor Snape and James Potter, where it's kind of, this is like one of those things where he just said he wouldn't lie. And what Dumbledore responds with is, well, they did detest each other, not unlike yourself and Mr. Malfoy. And then your father did something Snape could never forgive. What? He saved his life.
Yeah, this really isn't the reason.
It's not really the
reason.
Because what we essentially get from this playing out, it suggests that James has a far more important bit of history left to be explained, which I don't think is wholly true.
Yeah.
Like, he, of course, is a member of the Marauders. He helped create the Marauder map. He was able to become an Animagus.
Yeah.
All of those types of details, and they figured out the Whomping Willow, which I think is what James Potter ultimately does save him from. But
he saves him from Remus.
Okay. Yeah. Who's a werewolf?
Who's a werewolf? Yeah. Who's what he's going to find if Snape goes through the Whomping Willow? And I think it's Sirius who has told Snape that, like, oh yeah, here's how you get through the Whomping Willow. You can find something crazy under there.
Yeah.
And then James is like, whoa. Let's not pump the brakes here, friend.
But this does not end up being relevant to the overall story. It's not relevant to the overall themes, to the overall plots, to anything.
It's not relevant. It is kind of a lie. The real reason he's saving it was because he loved Lily. And that's the reason.
Yep.
There's also his explanation for, like, Lily's death. It says, your mother died to say you saved you. If there's one thing Voldemort cannot understand, it is love. He didn't realize that love, as powerful as your mother's for you, leaves its own mark. No, not a scar, no visible sign. To have been loved so deeply, even though the person who loved us is gone, will give us some protection forever. Like, I don't love, like, it skates around the answer to how the sacrificial love charm works, but, like, I feel like the way he presents it just makes it sound like, as long as anyone's mom loves them enough, Voldemort won't be able to hurt them, kind of thing. And it's like, what? It makes it just sound like no other mom would have died for their kid. And it's just like, that is just patently false. And it's like, you have missed the crucial information. Again, it's about Snape being in love with Lily, but that it is because he offered to let her live and she chooses to die. Like, that is the crucial bit of difference here.
Yeah, sacrificial protection, it's like, it does seem like it needs to come with, and sometimes this happens in the story anyway, but it comes with a whole bunch of caveats where it's sort of like, well, you have to have very special circumstances, and this has to happen, and that needs to be in play, and, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, otherwise, because it does seem like, this was one of my biggest questions for the longest time about the whole saga, was it was sort of like, it just doesn't seem like Lily would have been the first person to have ever...
jumped in front of their child.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And maybe that's also just still true. It's just the fate of, all of wizard kind wasn't hinging on that particular behavior and on those occasions, if that makes sense. So, like, maybe other people have been protected from attacks from other people, but they were just maybe less overall relevant to history.
Right. Like, it didn't knock down the Dark Lord or it's like, and the other thing is, well, who's to say? I mean, it doesn't have to be over, like, a baby either.
That's also true.
Or a family member.
Because Harry is able to enact the exact same kind of protection over all of the...
defenders of Hogwarts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's a good point as well. But anyway, so as we then trudge forward, we basically have, like, another one of these, like, nice little exchanges that I think kind of comes back to the core of who, like, Dumbledore is, with the Bertie Bott's Every Flavored Beans. And he basically is, like, they're just having, like, essentially, like, one of the most pivotal and important conversations for all of the humanity of these people. And then it's like, let's talk about jelly beans.
Yeah.
Right. And then we get the all too famous, alas, earwax.
Yes, there's that. I also like the line here where he reveals that he's the one who gave him the invisibility cloak, and he says it was your father's, and your father used it mainly for sneaking off to the kitchens to steal food when he was here. It's like, what I love about that sentence is that it implies that whilst James was sneaking off to the kitchens, like, Dumbledore just, like, openly knows about it and does not care. Right? He's just like, because we've talked about this before, that like Dumbledore like is just so okay with the students like sort of testing the rules.
Yeah.
Like he almost like encourages it.
Like a little like, light
even when Filch is like, Mr. Filch reminds me to tell you that all of the secret passages located here are off limits. Definitely don't go there, wink.
You can do it.
You can do it.
It might be good for you. Little light rule breaking never hurt anybody.
Right.
He does not, however, know about their Animagus abilities.
He does not know about that. You're right. That is sneaky.
That's kind of an interesting one, because that somehow, some way, I wonder if that makes Animagus magic more powerful than we're even giving it credit for, which is already quite a bit. But it makes me wonder if it's like undetectable in a way that is kind of like unique.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because if he knows about like the invisibility cloak, it feels like he would certainly know that like all of these guys are running around in the middle of the night, especially when he specifically sets up the Whomping Willow and the Shrieking Shack
for Remus
for the same reason why the rest of them are Animagus.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah, but like, yeah, him not knowing is a crucial bit of information, because then he would know how Sirius is getting in and out of the castle.
Also true.
Right. So like, he definitely does not know.
Yeah.
Also, there's Harry asked the question, how did I get the stone out of the mirror? Which I love the answer to. But my question is always, how did he get the stone in the mirror? You know?
I know. Yeah.
Which I want to say there was a stab at answering in the Fantastic Beasts Secrets of Dumbledore movie, where him and Dumbledore and Credence have this like fight inside of like a mirror verse sort of thing. And it's like, oh, Dumbledore did a thing with a mirror again. And he like uses the Deluminator to like go upside down or something, but we don't really ever get much of an answer for that.
Yeah, I know. And we've talked a lot before about how Dumbledore has a particular fascination with the Resurrection Stone, because he of course wants to be able to bring back his family. You know, part of like what he sees inside of the Mirror of Erised, almost certainly. I mean, we know what in younger years he sees Grindelwald, who he loved, but then I think later in life he would have seen again his family happy and whole is pretty much the argument. And then the Deluminator has sort of like the unique ability that we see with Ron, which is effectively that it can allow you to return to people you love if they say your name.
Yeah.
And supposedly the Deluminator is an invention of Dumbledore's own, which may suggest that what he was attempting to create was the ability to travel from wherever he was to the place of his loved ones, which in his particular case is going to be beyond the grave, and therefore they are then unable to ever speak his name. So it's like Dumbledore may not even be sure whether or not the Deluminator works the way that he thinks it does, because he's never been able to successfully use it. All of this to say, though, is that part of the reason, because we also know, again, thanks to Fantastic Beasts, that Dumbledore has had the mirror himself for a long time, over 50 years. So I think that there's a very, very, very reasonable possibility that Dumbledore is probably on scale with the talents and abilities of at least the second Peverell brother, who supposedly invented the Resurrection Stone.
Yeah.
And probably with that same level of ability, probably in study over these devices, or the stone, the mirror, the Deluminator.
Yeah.
All of which, in my opinion, kind of are attempting to achieve similar outcomes, that maybe he's able to unlock certain potentials or abilities of the mirror that I would argue no one else was capable of.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So that's how I would piece all of that together. That's my answer to that question.
Great. Okay, moving on. Hermione and Ron come in and get the whole breakdown from Harry as well. This is just a fun little thing. Ron reveals that Gryffindor was steamrolled by Ravenclaw without you, which I think means Cho won a game.
Possibly. Right. I know. I wondered about this as well. Was she playing as a second
year? Was she
as
a senior yet? I don't know.
Because she's just 1 year ahead. The only thing I thought was ridiculous about this.
I guess that would make her a second year, right?
It would make her a second year. Yeah. So it's possible.
Possible.
Almost the youngest Quidditch player in a century.
That'd be so funny. I mean, Draco's right there in year two as well.
Also true. But he buys his way on the team.
So yeah, but he's still there. He's it would still count for the record books.
It would still count.
History's not going to have that asterisk next to it.
Probably not. The thing that I find ridiculous about this is that it means that they've already taken their final exams, which means they haven't played the final Quidditch match yet, which just seems unlikely.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, it's just like, really? You mean to tell me that they play the last game of the season in like the last 3 days of the year?
Yeah, right.
Which I suppose is possible, but I want to fact check it with every other book and see if this also holds.
Yeah, right.
True. How much time is left after they win the Quidditch World Cup in, not the Quidditch World Cup, the House Cup?
Yeah.
Yeah.
After they win the Quidditch Cup before the end of the year.
Yeah, I was mixing all my words there.
That's okay. Yeah, no, you're right. We're going to keep an eye on that because you're right. It's weird that it happens in the last week of the year after classes have ended.
Yes, yes.
Also, speaking of classes of ending, there's like this thing where they get the grades back, which you never hear about. And they've all made it to second year. Even Goyle?
Even Goyle,
which just to me is just like, all right. Guys, how much are we overemphasizing the end of year exams? Because like if Goyle's passing, they just can't be that hard. They just can't be.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Not even a little bit. The thing I thought was particularly interesting about that exchange is just simply that they talk about Goyle and not Crab.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're always, Crab and Goyle are always like,
always a pair.
Like a pair. Yeah. And it's like, so that must mean that Crab is a little bit smarter.
A little bit smarter.
Just a little bit. Yeah. Kind of edged him out. We also get an early nod to Neville's good herbology mark, which I think is kind of fun, because that ends up kind of continuing pretty much throughout the entire series. So it's nice that it's established so early. We also get all the allocation of the house points, which ultimately wins Gryffindor the House Cup.
The House Cup. Yeah, but not the Quidditch Cup.
Not the Quidditch Cup. Where Hermione and Ron both receive 50 points each. Harry receives 60 points. And then Neville, it says, it takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to our enemies, but just as much to stand up to our friends.
I actually like the movie quote a little better there where he says, but a great deal more to stand up to your friends.
I agree wholeheartedly. Standing up to your friends is tough because this is like one of those things where it's like if there are people out there in the world who vehemently disagree with your point of view or, you know, hold like a subpar stance on something, I'm not worried about those people being upset with
me.
I worry about the people who I care for, the people I want to look out for, the people, you know, that I love. Those are the people I don't want to let down.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what it feels like you're doing, you know, by standing up to your friends is like that fear of like, you know, potentially risking the friendships, you know, in exchange for doing what you think is right inside of that moment. So
clearly it pays off for Neville. My only thing about the House Cup here, and I will, this is that like that, like, I'm so happy Harry wins and they definitely deserved it and whatever. But like it comes at like such a, like as such a, it is delivered as such like a blow to Slytherin at the same time. And it's like, and you know, Draco is being a little jerk throughout this whole book, but he's the only Slytherin, you know, to be like a total, to be a jerk.
Right.
Like the rest of them are maybe like a little mean spirited, but like they're not at the top of the House Cup for no reason.
Exactly. Like they did still outcompete the other two.
A
significant margin.
Yeah. It's not even close.
Yeah.
Like I do feel a little bad for the Slytherins because it's like they didn't do anything wrong in this book.
Right.
You know, other than what you know about Draco, but like they, even with Draco, like he loses points and stuff at certain points. And it's like, they're still winning by a wide margin. So I'm always like a little, like, it's a little like, I feel like the book is a little rude to Slytherin here because they definitely earned it.
I know. This is I always think this is kind of funny because it's like when I was a kid, you know, I mean, just a tangent outside of the Wizarding World for just one quick second. I remember like we were big fans of the Virginia Tech Hokies.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, like as a small child, their main rivals, the University of Virginia Cavaliers.
Yeah.
It was like I always saw them as like not only like our opposition, you know, our rivals, our foes or whatever, but probably like unethical people.
Yeah.
You know, like who are doing terrible, terrible things in the world, which
deserve all the bad things that happen to them.
Yeah. Yeah. But don't, obviously don't, you know, it's like one of those things as I got older and I was a college student myself and I was like, oh, these are all just hardworking individuals who are out there who are excited to have excelled at their sport,
right?
And are, you know, like, they're not mean people. They're just the opposition. That's right. All it is.
Like, so everyone's not cheating their way to the top of the House Cup. The teachers are the ones giving out the points.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a little bit dicey, and you do feel a little bit bad for Slytherin kind of getting overtaken there. The thing I do always kind of credit back to the Gryffindors, though, who are currently in fourth place, is that they did lose 150 points for helping out Hagrid.
Yeah.
So, you know, it feels like maybe a couple points for, like, you know, helping out an old friend, you know.
Yeah.
Could have counted towards something, but, you know, they're basically recovering
most of that,
and then an extra 30 points on top,
right?
So, or is that
20 math, right? points 20 on points top, on top. Yeah.
Yeah, so nothing. So basically, they're winning 20 points.
They're winning 20 points for beating
Voldemort.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and when you put it like that, it seems like maybe not enough.
It's like Ron Weasley 200 points, Hermione 200 points.
That is what happens at the end of next year, where Harry and Ron both get like 200 points. Each.
I know, yeah.
Dumbledore's just like, whatever, Gryffindor wins, who cares?
Back of the napkin math. Yeah. I can figure this out, no big deal.
This one, he's like, let me make it really close. Let me just be like, wow, they just barely edged him out, okay? Wow, what a close one. The next year, he's like, I don't want to do the math, okay? What? Okay, 400 points, done.
Sure.
Surely that's enough.
I don't need to even fact check it. We'll be fine. So anyway, that basically, though, does bring us to the end of book one.
Yes, it does.
Stone.
How exciting. What a fun first book for the end of book. It's like our first big milestone for the podcast.
I know. There's a huge part of me that wonders, because I as a listener, you know, of podcasts myself, I feel like there's a decent possibility that I would have been hesitant to start until there was an end so that I knew I could go through a full season. I could go the whole season.
Well, now you can.
I know. So now you can. Now, in fact, we have made it through one whole book. Hopefully you guys have enjoyed the whole ride with us. We have had an absolute blast getting to dissect this story on such a, like, you know, minuscule basis. I was looking, I think it takes about 9 hours at standard speed to listen to all of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone on Audible. And we have over 20 hours of discussion on this particular book at this point in time. So we have quite literally doubled the length of time it would just take to listen to the book at regular speed.
There you go.
There you go. Hope you guys have enjoyed. Looking forward to next week's episode, which will be chapter one, The Worst Birthday.
Oh yeah. Join us next time through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.